It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
The Ebola death toll nears 4,900. The UN warns the deadly virus is causing a growing food crisis in West Africa. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The African Union chief, Kosazana Dlamini Zuma, is in Ghana at the start of a tour of the three hardest-hit countries, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, to assess the situation firsthand. The World Health Organization Wednesday put the Ebola death toll at nearly 4,900 since the outbreak first was detected in March. It says the number of confirmed cases is nearly 10,000. Liberia remains the hardest hit with nearly 4,700 cases and more than 2,700 fatalities. The UN Health Agency warns the transmission of the disease in the past week is the most intense in the capitals of all three countries and is spreading toward Ivory Coast. Among those affected by the illness, 443 healthcare workers, 244 of whom have died. The Democratic Republic of Congo, hit by a separate strain of Ebola, the WHO noted 66 cases and 49 deaths, the fatality rate about 70%. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization warned Wednesday that if the epidemic is not brought under control soon, West Africa faces a food crisis. Dominique Bourgeon is director of FAO Emergencies.
It's clear that the longer this Ebola crisis lasts, the deeper the impact on food security will be, and the more difficult it will be for people to recover and to recover their livelihoods in the aftermath of this massive disaster that is still increasing as we speak.
In eastern Sierra Leone Wednesday, at least two killed in clashes between police and youths over an attempt by healthcare workers to take a blood test of a 90-year-old woman suspected of having Ebola. This is VOA News. Multinational corporation Nestle says it has no plans to close any of its eight factories or curb cocoa and coffee production in West and Central Africa over Ebola, but is preparing for the worst. Paul Bulke is chief executive of the world's biggest food company.
Let's put Ebola where it has to be. This is a major issue, and that's where the high alert that I pronounced came from. As a society, and we as a company part of that society, whenever it happens, we're going to have to adjust, to adapt. That is what we are good at. We are part of this country, so we're going to do what is necessary.
Nestle has factories in Ghana and Ivory Coast. A team of Cuban healthcare workers has arrived in Liberia. Jorge Lesebre Nicolas is Cuba's ambassador to Liberia.
We cannot see how our brothers and sisters of Africa are in difficult times, and we are there in our homes in Cuba. So we feel that we have the duty to come to help.
Cuba has trained more than 460 doctors and nurses to fight the deadly virus, although only 256 have been dispatched. In Sierra Leone, Britain's International Development Secretary Justine Greeney Wednesday ended a two-day visit at the site of a British-funded Ebola treatment center in Kerrytown.
Well, I think we've seen an immense amount of progress on this site just over the last few weeks. We've got over 300 people who are working round the clock to make sure that this Kerrytown facility comes on stream soon. It'll be providing 92 beds for patients, of which 12 will be dedicated for healthcare workers, providing people who are coming here to provide healthcare support the reassurance that if they do get sick, in spite of all of the work we're doing on training, that they will be able to make sure they get the treatment that they need.
The UK expects to have 750 military personnel in Sierra Leone by month's end. In Libya, troops entered the contested eastern city Benghazi, controlled by Islamists since July. For the first time Wednesday in 2 months, the French press agency reports at least 11 people killed, bringing the death toll to 110 in the city since former General Khalifa Haftar launched an assault last week. In Nigeria, nearly a week after the government announced a ceasefire agreement with the Islamist militant group Boko Haram, there's still no sign of more than 200 abducted schoolgirls being freed. The fighting continues. Officials had indicated the two sides would meet for talks in Chad, but as of Wednesday, those talks had not taken place. A bomb exploded outside the campus of Cairo University Wednesday, wounding at least 9, including 6 policemen. It detonated following clashes between police and pro-Islamist students. The group Ajnad Mezer, which is linked to the killings of several policemen in past explosions, claimed responsibility. The Sudanese political opposition is critical of President Omar al-Bashir's bid for re-election next year, saying his ruling National Congress Party doesn't respect democracy. The 70-year-old Mr. Bashir, under indictment by the International Criminal Court, took power in a coup in 1989 and has ruled ever since. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Sierra Leone says dozens of patients were successfully treated and declared Ebola-free.
Every time you hear Ebola, it's about the deaths and infections and all that. Yes, it is true, but we are also making strides in trying to get people healed from this disease.
Alpha Kanu is Sierra Leone's information minister. What will be the impact of budget reductions on Sierra Leone's ability to fight Ebola? A new report accuses Western countries of luring African doctors away from the continent. And a United Nations official says it is time to silence the guns in South Sudan's ongoing conflict.
After only 6 weeks in South Sudan, I'm convinced that every day without a political agreement contributes to a further deterioration of the situation on the ground.
Ellen Marguerite Loy is the United Nations envoy to South Sudan. Former abductees will talk about life in Boko Haram captivity. A Tanzanian opposition politician will explain why they plan to challenge a scheduled constitutional referendum, and Somalia gets its first ever ATM machine. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sierra Leone's information minister says the fight against Ebola in his country received a significant boost after dozens of patients were successfully treated and discharged from Ebola treatment centers near the capital of Freetown. Alpha Kanu says the discharges give hope to Sierra Leoneans infected with the virus that they have a chance of survival. He tells reporter Peter Clotty that the government has seen a success rate of over 35% since launching the fight against Ebola.
This has been happening ever since we started having Ebola cases. There have been deaths, but the survival rate has been quite high, 36, 35, sometimes even 40%. We have so far 652 survivors today. Even the new treatment center that was put up by the police and the military at the police training school on the 19th of September, at the beginning of the lockdown, has passed out about 134 people today, which were Ebola-free. And believe that they are doing the right things, because if we can have up to 652 survivors, it means there must be something that is being done right. It is to strengthen this, to enforce this, and also to capacitate those people who are doing that so that they can do much more. So that is the good story. Every time you hear Ebola, it's about the deaths and the infections and all that. Yes, it is true, but we are also making strides in trying to get people healed from this disease.
How were they treated, especially when people say that there is no known cure for the treatment of the Ebola disease?
Well, Ebola is caused by a virus, we're told. This virus is new in the region, but the symptoms of the disease that it presents are not new symptoms. These are diarrhea, these are cholera-type symptoms, fever, malaria and all that, for which we have known cures. So what the doctors do is that they treat the symptoms, and then they try and strengthen the immunity by giving them good nutrition and also giving them some vitamin supplements. And this is why we believe that they are able to withstand the disease. So I believe that this roundabout way is a cure, even if we don't have a direct silver bullet to do it.
What does this discharge mean to the fight against the Ebola virus that has been infecting some people in Sierra Leone for some time now?
Well, the discharge means hope for people. It means hope for even those who have not yet contracted the disease, and hopefully they will not contract it. Because if the disease has survivors, that it means there must be a way out. The impression that was given before is that when Ebola catches anybody, it's a death sentence. But now we know that through some very intuitive and imaginative treatments, people are coming out of this. And for the rest of the population, there is hope that we can control this disease eventually.
Alpha Kanu is the Sierra Leone's information minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Freetown. According to local press reports, the Sierra Leone government has announced a 23% reduction in ministry budgets next year, including from the Ministry of Social Welfare, which oversees Ebola-related issues such as caring for children who have lost their parents to the virus. as well as counseling survivors. Simeon Sandy, a regional gender officer in the eastern part of the country, tells Ricky Shryak that in addition to Ebola-related issues, the proposed decrease in the 2015 budget will hurt his office's ability to address domestic violence and teenage pregnancy.
We are manning the psychosocial and the child protection and gender in the Ebola response. Vis-a-vis, we are providing social support for all survivors and even affected persons. And we are doing the rapid registration of children, orphan children, to households.
How many orphans has the ministry so far counted from the Ebola crisis?
For only Kenema District, because I'm covering Kenema District. Now, I've recorded over 400 now.
Where are these orphans going? Are you finding problems putting them into homes? Is there a social stigma attached to these orphans?
What we are doing now is these orphans, we have an interim care center. We are finding caregivers in these communities. This is Africa. We have extended families. Maybe a relative of the parents who died will be willing to take these children, to provide care for these children. So we are placing them in this care.
And you're not finding people are less willing to take in these orphans than other orphans, for instance, because of the stigma attached to Ebola?
Yes, we are having a lot of problems. A lot of people don't want to take children because of the stigma. But there are some relatives who are willing.
So there is this talk of reducing the budget by 23% because the Sierra Leone government has had a reduction in income due to the Ebola crisis. Are you guys already working on a low budget? What kind of care would have to be cut off from Ebola survivors or Ebola orphans?
It's going to be really, really hard because all of the programs are really, really important. But because of Ebola emergency, I think we're going to concentrate more on the Ebola response because there is everything in Ebola. There is child protection in Ebola, there are gender issues in Ebola, there are social issues in Ebola.
That was Simeon Sandy, a regional gender officer for the Sierra Leone Ministry of Social Welfare. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Kenema, Sierra Leone. Health systems in the West African countries worst hit by Ebola are struggling to contain the epidemic. A report from British charity accuses Western countries of recruiting hundreds of doctors and nurses from Africa, thereby severely weakening the frontline health services in the very countries where the disease has taken hold. Henry Richwell reports from London.
Amid the fear of the epidemic, a moment of joy for these patients in Sierra Leone. 45 patients at the Hastings Treatment Centre near the capital, Freetown, were confirmed to be Ebola-free on Wednesday. 14-year-old survivor Hawanatu Toure expressed relief.
I feel good because nothing asked me again. I'll be fine.
She said, I can eat fine, my stomach hurts no more, my headache no more. And also my neck, nothing hurts and I have no more pains. The centre is staffed exclusively by Sierra Leonean doctors. That's rare in Sierra Leone's crippled health system, says Martin Drury, director of the charity Health Poverty Action.
The important thing to remember is that whilst an Ebola outbreak is caused biologically, an Ebola epidemic is caused by a rundown, dysfunctional health system.
Drury says underinvestment is to blame, but so is the plundering by Western countries of health workers trained in Africa. A recent report from Health Poverty Action claims that Britain's National Health Service, or NHS, has recruited 10% of all Sierra Leone's trained medical workers.
Even before Ebola, you had just 320 hospital beds in the whole of Sierra Leone. The system was that weak before Ebola. Now it's incredibly weak. And yet, at the same time, people like me in the UK are being treated by doctors and health workers whose training was paid for by Sierra Leone. And that's just wrong.
In a statement, Britain's Department of Health said that healthcare professionals often want to spend time working in different healthcare systems to gain experience and skills. The British government highlights its leading role in the international fight against Ebola. London is deploying 750 military personnel. The United States is deploying 4,000 troops to fight Ebola in West Africa. Liberia is one of the worst-hit countries. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf recently urged the hundreds of Liberian medics working overseas to return home. But her own son, a trained doctor, has opted to stay working in his adopted homeland of the United States, claiming he can do more to fight the disease there. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 23rd. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 and a half minutes past the hour. The world waits to see if Nigeria can successfully negotiate the release of the 219 Chibok schoolgirls taken in April by the militant sect Boko Haram. But activists say those girls are the tip of the iceberg, and Boko Haram has taken hundreds of young men, women, and children using various forms of coercion or enticement. Viewers and Luke reports from Gombe, Nigeria.
Boko Haram took Haja Hafsatu Bube's two teenage sons. She saw them round up 20 boys in all the day they took her town of Gwoza almost 2 months ago. She says, I begged them, leave these boys. They are students. They attend Islamic school. And they said, but that is what we want. We want them to also go into our Islamic school. Her eyes glisten. She says another mother with her collapsed. Their sons had no choice but to go. Haja rents a few rooms in Gombe now. Whole neighborhoods of displaced Northeasterners have risen up here, on the outskirts of the state capital in the past 5 years. A few hundred others, some more recent arrivals, live at a state-run camp. 33-year-old Abdurrahman Musa came on foot from Michika, near the border with Cameroon. He hid in the house when militants seized the town in September. He says they were going house to house, searching rooms for able-bodied men. When they came, he says, I jumped out the back door and escaped. As he ran, he saw bodies beheaded. Many at this camp in Gombe come from Damboa, a Borno State district and town of the same name, about 200 kilometers to the northeast. 75-year-old Alhaji Abubakar Umar leans on his cane, the sharp-eyed patriarch of a six-family farm. They left it all behind. Boko Haram took four of his nephews. He says, I have no hope. We haven't heard from them in 3 months since they left. He says, I don't think we will see them again. Activists working with men who have later escaped say the men report being given some training and say Christians are forced to convert. They say Boko Haram makes the new recruits charge out in front in battle, a kind of human shield. Locals say Boko Haram has used other methods, too, to get men to join as they have gobbled up territory this year. A resident of the Damboa district, Musa Ibrahim, says Boko Haram would try to entice the young men out in the villages, promising them money if they join, as much as $1,200. He says they would also come around to tax the communities, telling them to contribute food or a certain number of able-bodied men or else. Anne Luck, VOA News, Gombe, Nigeria.
The new United Nations envoy to South Sudan said Wednesday that the guns must be silenced in that country as the humanitarian crisis grows and there are gross violations of human rights. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
In her first briefing to the UN Security Council, Ellen Marguerite Loy said she is shocked by what she said is the complete disregard for human life she has seen since arriving in South Sudan. Loy said peace cannot be delayed for even one more day, and there is no alternative to a comprehensive peace agreement.
The untold suffering of the people of South Sudan must stop. After only 6 weeks in South Sudan, I'm convinced that every day without a political agreement contributes to a further deterioration of the situation on the ground.
She said the UN mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, is still sheltering 100,000 civilians at 9 protection sites around the country. Nearly 2 million people have been forced to flee their homes because of the violence, with nearly a half million of them seeking safety in neighboring countries. About a third of the population is facing severe food insecurity. South Sudan erupted into violence late last year. A political dispute between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy, Riek Machar, has divided factions of the military and led to inter-ethnic fighting that has killed at least 10,000 people. The UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence and Conflict, Zainab Hawa-Bangoura, briefed the council on her recent visit to South Sudan. Speaking via a video link from Geneva, she said the conditions that displaced persons are living in are some of the worst she has ever seen. She warned that sexual violence is widespread,
including acts of rape, gang rape, abductions, forced marriage, and sexual slavery, and mutilation of sexual organs. These violations have been perpetrated by all sides in the conflict.
Bangoura said sexual violence in South Sudan existed before the outbreak of violence last December, but since the crisis, it has reached alarming levels expressed in a vicious cycle of retribution and revenge. Bangoura said she is also gravely concerned about ethnic dimensions of sexual attacks, especially in targeting and reprisals between the Dinka and Nuer communities. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Tanzania's main opposition, Chadema, and other rival political parties say they are preparing to launch a legal challenge to the government's decision to hold a referendum next year about the country's draft constitution. Ibrahim Lipumba is a leading member of the consultative assembly that helped draft the proposed measure. He tells reporter Peter Clotty that President Jakaya Kikwete's administration failed to follow current laws during the vote in parliament to endorse the constitution, which he said could plunge the country into chaos and violence.
There are many factors that we are challenging. The first one is that in fact the constitution was not passed legally in the Constituent Assembly, because in order to pass the constitution, we had to vote on Zanzibar as well as on Tanzania mainland. And the government did not have two-thirds majority on the Zanzibar part, but they included even in the voting situation, people were not in the assembly itself. And therefore, even people who had left the Constituent Assembly and they were not participating in the assembly, they said that they can vote by email or by fax. And therefore, they just rigged the numbers and declared that they had two-thirds on both parts of the union.
Some people are saying that the opposition is to be blamed for refusing to fully participate in the process and then complain after the process has gone forward and it to be put before Tanzanians to vote on a new constitution.
We boycotted because the laws were not being respected. Because if you have a process that is rigged, in the first place, and continuing participating in that particular process, you are actually become part and parcel of this particular process. So in order to protest, we had to protest and get out of the sham. And in any case, we don't even have a voters register to be able to carry out a referendum. The National Electoral Commission has stated categorically it is not in a position to carry out any election as of now because they don't have a voters register.
Some people are saying this is a foregone conclusion because of the enormous support the ruling or governing party appear to enjoy in the country, and that the fact that this goes before Tanzanians, they are going to have what they wanted, which is endorsement by the people of the proposed constitution, and that is why the opposition is crying foul. What do you say to that?
No, it's the government is not that popular. It is the rigging. That they want to rig the elections to be guaranteed to win in the referendum. And we are saying that no, we are not going to accept the rigging of the elections.
Ibrahim Lipumba is the leader of Tanzania's opposition Civic United Front. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Dar es Salaam. As Somalia emerges from decades of lawlessness, the almost non-existent banking sector is starting to develop. The country's first ever ATM machine and a new bank give Somalis the ability to make transactions with people and companies abroad. Abdulaziz Bello has more from Mogadishu.
The International Bank of Somalia is one of a kind here. The newly opened bank is the only one in the country that can facilitate the transfer of remittances from abroad, a role previously filled only by money transfer companies. It is also the first bank in Somalia to offer mortgages, deposit accounts, overdraft facilities, and trade finances to non-resident customers. After years of turmoil and uncertainty, many in Mogadishu see the bank's emergence as a sign that the country is stabilizing. Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, who attended the opening ceremony of the financial institution, say that the country is ready to move to a new level of doing business. He says that the opening of the International Bank of Somalia is a clear sign that the country is safe for investment and that the development of Somalia will serve as a role model that will in turn make the capital Mogadishu a land of investment. The Somali president also says the new bank should attract investors. He called on the business community to have confidence in the bank and transfer their assets from banks in countries like Kenya and the United Arab Emirates. He says that the new bank will offer badly needed international services which will be reliable. Analysts like Abdurrahman Ainte say developing key institutions like banks that offer international services is a sign of an improving and an emerging economy. He says this is a sign that the country is safe enough for international business and that Somalis are gaining trust and confidence in their own country. And in a symbolic sign of that trust, Mogadishu has its first automated teller machine.
That was Abdulaziz Bello reporting from Mogadishu. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Nigeria Super Falcons and Cameroon's indomitable Lionesses emerged victorious in keenly contested semifinals at the Telecom Namibia Mobile Africa Women's Championships at the Sam Nujoma Stadium in Katutura Township, Windhoek, Namibia, on Wednesday. In the first semifinal, Nigeria's Asisat Oshoala proved why she was voted FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup Most Valuable Player when she scored a brace against South Africa's Banyana Banyana just before the interval. On resumption of play, Jane Rifilwe found the back of the net for Banyana Banyana. This spurred both teams to step up the tempo of play, producing excitement at both ends of the field before Kenyan referee Damaris Wangari blew the final whistle to end the match 2-1 in Nigeria's favour. Later on, the showdown between Cameroon's indomitable Lionesses and Ivory Coast's Lady Elephants was just as thrilling, with neither side finding the back of the net in the first half. Cameroon's 22-year-old striker Deborah Enganamoit put the indomitable Lionesses into the lead in the 60th minute. Ivory Coast's Tia Viho Ines leveled the score 7 minutes later. With the teams deadlocked at a goal each after 90 minutes, the match went into extra time. Cameroon's captain and central defender Christine Mani scored from a corner 2 minutes before Ethiopian referee Lydia Tafese's final whistle ended extra time. This ensured Cameroon squeezed past Ivory Coast 2-1. This is the second time Ivory Coast have qualified for the finals. Staying in Windhoek, by virtue of advancing to the finals, Nigeria's Super Falcons and Cameroon's indomitable Lionesses qualify for the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. Fans can this time expect a pulsating bronze medal playoff. At stake is the third and final slot for Africa at the FIFA Women's World Cup. South Africa edged Ivory Coast 2-1 when they hosted them in a friendly in Moruleng in South Africa's Northwest Province last month. This time, fans can expect nothing friendly about the encounter. Finally, in cricket, Uganda tackled Nepal at the start of the Pepsi ICC World Cricket League Division 3 in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, today, Thursday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. U.S. federal health authorities are ordering travelers from three West African countries to monitor their health for 21 days and report daily for any signs of Ebola. The visitors will be from Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, the epicenter of the Ebola outbreak. And that's it for this Thursday, October 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty, I'm James Potty in Washington, wishing you a very good Thursday.
Time in Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me I'm Heather Maxwell for Music Time in Africa. Every Saturday and Sunday at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC.